To celebrate Harmony Week, SA Met is shining a light on the diversity in the medical workforce and training pathways. Today I have Dr. Michael Cusack here with me, who is the Chief Medical Officer of SA Health. So thank you for taking the time to chat with
me. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. So I'd like to talk to you about your training journey and how that led you to Australia. So let's start from the beginning. Can you please describe your training journey and pathway?
Okay, so my training journey goes back some way. So although I know I need to keep my answers short and to the point, I do need to sort of draw you all the way back to 1992, which is when I qualified in the UK. So as you've implied, I'm an overseas doctor. And so in 92, I did what would be the equivalent of internship, though in the UK at the time, you did two jobs effectively. You did a medical job and a surgical job over the course of a year. And then you were registered and then you kind of choose your path. To some extent, I think my path slightly chose me because I had considered that I wanted to take a surgical tack. For reasons that I think are slightly unclear to me now, looking back all those years, I ended up instead taking a medical tack, and so sort of did general, what we would have called general medical training for a couple of years while I passed an exam membership of the College of Physicians in the UK. And then around that time, it would be usual to sort of sub-specialise into a medical specialty. To some degree, looking back over the specialties that I'd experienced up to that point, I was particularly taken with cardiology. So I started training as a cardiologist in 1995, so only 3 years really after having got my initial qualification. I could go on, but I don't want to take it in case you've got other questions that are around that line.
I'll leave it at that. That definitely sounds like an interesting journey you've had there. So many in the audience are starting off in their careers as well.
Okay.
So when you consider your journey, can you tell us who or what influenced your decisions and the path you took?
Sure. Well, I think in a way, if I jump forward slightly in time, because up to that point, I think it was fairly generic in terms of training in cardiology. But then once you, and I guess as some trainees who are listening into this, will have already perhaps experienced, once you're in a specialty, then there's often a sub-specialisation that then takes place. So I've been kind of heading along in cardiology for a couple of years. I'd spent a year out in what we would have called a district hospital doing general medicine and cardiology before moving into a main centre, which at the time was Guy's Hospital in London, and then subsequent to that, St Thomas's Hospital, where I was at for quite a few years. And I actually was particularly interested in electrical elements of cardiology, I suppose the opportunity presented itself to train in coronary intervention, so in angioplasty or PCI, as it would be called now. And my trainer, as it were, was also heavily involved in research. So when the time came, we had a lot of discussion around doing a clinical further research degree, so a doctorate in medicine, an MD. And I was fortunate, I guess, because I was able to combine that with ongoing clinical training. So for those 3 years, as well as doing research and trying to answer what I considered to be quite an important research question, I also spent a lot of time in the cath lab and still contributing to outpatient clinics and so forth. So I found that was a very useful way of sort of doing a research degree as well as combining with clinical training. I think one challenge that people might experience is that it's not uncommon to be offered or to need to do research, a PhD or an MD, in order to get into, say, surgical training or certain medical specialty training. And I think an issue that can arise with that is that what seems important in terms of research questions at that point in your career, when you've actually had a few years then in your chosen surgical specialty, say, it may be that isn't so important to your surgical future. So I think my view would be the longer you can defer that kind of research decision making in terms of which avenue you're going to pursue from a research perspective, I think the better, because the later you leave it, the more clear you'll be in your own mind what are important things to you. To give you an example, a good friend of mine was the sort of head of ophthalmology training at Moorfields Hospital in London, which is quite a famous eye hospital in the UK. And he'd said that there were instances of people that had done a PhD in a very advanced field in neuro-ophthalmology, But then when they came to surgical training, having completed their PhD, they really struggled with elements of surgery, be it fine tremor in the hand that was making it difficult to do very fine eye surgery. And in some rare instances, it wasn't possible for people to continue their surgical training because of various issues that that may have arisen. And that clearly is a huge shame after you've contributed 3 or 4 years of full-time work to a research degree. So I think that's certainly something I would advise people to give thought to.
Okay, cool.
As we're joined by the drilling now.
Yes. Thanks. That's definitely some good advice for our TMOs and future TMOs as well. So the next question is around training challenges. So can you describe a training challenge and how you overcame that challenge? And also on reflection of this challenge, what did you learn you will always remember?
I think that's quite a tough question. I think in a way, because and the reason I say that is that I think you actually experience quite a few challenges of one sort or another through your training. I guess one thing that emerges perhaps early on is balancing clinical workload with actually gaining experience that contributes to your training, so that is making you effectively a better doctor. And I think that can be a really hard balance to strike, particularly in a very busy unit. I think because, and so I'll come to a specific, but because of busyness, I think often there's not a great deal of time for self-reflection and to think about what have you learned or what have you seen and how you would apply that to say seeing a particular condition in future, or if you were to encounter a scenario a second time, how would your first experience help you with managing the second? I don't have a ready solution to that, because I think, you know, the service demands will always be there, but I do think that, you know, people need to be kind to themselves and need to give themselves, you know, time as well to reflect on what they're seeing and what they're learning, and just allow it to kind of percolate through when they do have a bit of downtime, just to kind of, you know, kind of get things ordered in their head. And I think as well, and I suppose this might relate to the South Australian context perhaps more than in the UK, where it can be that a doctor would train in one unit or one institution for quite a lot of their time, whereas perhaps in the UK there's more of a tendency to move between hospitals and move between regions when regions are that bit closer together than they are in Australia, obviously, not just a bit, quite a lot closer together. And I think I would definitely encourage people coming through to really look at, let's say they want to be a surgeon, but getting surgical experience in different locations and different settings. So the same operation done in a regional setting might be very different than that done in a really high-end, very advanced institution. And I think as well, a second thing I would say is that working with as many different people as possible, as many different consultants, because although 80% of medicine is relatively routine and so forth, even seeing it being done by a range of different people, the same condition managed by three different individuals may be managed with subtleties three different ways. And I think at the end of your training, what you would like to do is sort of look at things and think, well, I like the way Dr. A managed this particular aspect, and I like the combination of Dr. A and Dr. B, and so in future I'm going to do it that way. Because I think almost you start to be able to select from a menu of ways that you've seen things done. And I think one specific, sorry for the lengthy answer here,
that's right.
One specific I would think, I was quite a senior registrar, so we have a sort of penultimate year, so you know, the kind of year before you formally finished training. And I'd moved out of London to Brighton, which is a nice place to have a year. But there was a sort of main regional cardiothoracic centre there on the south coast of the UK. And there was one particular cardiologist going on his ward rounds with, and just his approach, his bedside manner, it wasn't specifically the clinical decisions he was making, but it was the way that he made them and the way particularly he involved the family and the patient. And so to give an example, when someone we arrived, you know, the whole troop was there, and he'd spoken to the patient, was going to make the plan to discharge them, he'd then take his dictaphone out of his pocket and write the discharge letter, dictate the discharge letter onto his dictaphone at the bedside. And now I guess people listening into that, into this, would be thinking, well, that's something I normally do. I have to write the discharge letters. But it was so instructive for us as a team, one, to hear the patient's journey described by him, and the way, you know, the way that he had seen what had happened to the patient, what the diagnosis was and the treatment plan. So hearing all of that was great. But I think as well for the patient, hearing him describe all of that, having only just described it, but now hearing him put it in the letter to the GP, was just such a good way of being. And I remember thinking, when I'm a consultant, that's how I want to be. I want to have a bedside manner like that. I want to involve people in that way. And so I think through your career, you see things that you particularly like, and definitely would encourage people to select those things and add them to their kind of toolkit for when they're a more senior doctor.
Yeah, definitely. So thank you for that. I think some of your answer answers the next question. So in your opinion, how does the UK training pathway differ to Australia's?
It's a good question. Well, clearly both training pathways are evolving, because there's you know, the truism in health that these, you know, that the only constant is change. And I think so some years ago, for instance, in the UK, the intern year moved to a 2-year foundation year program. So foundation year two and one and two. And then within that, there were 4-month blocks so that you would rotate through six things over the course of 2 years. And there was much more structure brought in and a curriculum and so forth. And my understanding is that that's now the process that's envisaged in Australia, so that whilst registration occurs at the end of year one, there's this 2-year transition to practice and more structure and so forth, which I think on the face of it is a good thing, rather than allowing chance to take us where we want to be. And you hope that by having, say, spent time in ED, you've learned all the things that ED has to offer. You're actually providing structure as to this is the expectation over an attachment in the emergency department. I think as well in regards to sort of surgical training, I think certainly what I observe in fellowship training, or when, you know, the more senior trainees, I think is similar to UK experience. Though one distinction I would draw is that I think in the UK now, surgically, it is quite uncommon even for a senior trainee to be doing operations unsupervised. And so, whereas, and by unsupervised, I mean with someone almost, you know, in the room as opposed to being available. And I think particularly emergency surgery. But I think, you know, there still is perhaps that tendency here that when a surgeon is of sufficient seniority, that the consultant is happy for them to be supervised sort of from a remote perspective. And whether we'll see a change in that. And it may not be, I think, in the UK that it's necessarily training driving this. It could be other considerations such as medical, legal, and so forth. But that might be something that we come to see, you know, because I suppose these medical legal things, if they're prevalent in one country, might become so here as well.
Definitely, thank you. So just a couple of more questions before we finish off. What advice do you have for TMOs or future TMOs who are thinking about training in Australia?
Well, look, I think from what I've observed, I think Australia is a great place to train. And I think that there is, you know, incredible structure and support and so forth. And I think just as I've alluded to, as you get into more senior, positions in procedural specialties, I think that opportunity to really not just learn the technical aspects of the job, but also the decision making, I think that is often the hardest bit of being a consultant.
Yeah.
So for my own specialty, doing an angioplasty technically may not be so tough, but actually deciding when it's appropriate to do the angioplasty, who to and so forth, those decisions can be the more challenging ones. And I think just around that decision making as well, I would say that, you know, I guess as a trainee, you want to learn the technical aspects of your job, particularly if you're a surgeon. You absolutely, you know, we would expect surgeons to be able to do surgery. But I think sometimes we can forget that some of the most important work of the surgeon happens before the patient ever arrives in theatre, in terms of deciding should they have an operation and counselling them and arriving at those decisions. So don't, I would say, don't underestimate the importance of the of that pre-work and outpatients and patient selection, and also the follow-through, because I think, again, focusing on the bit in the middle, that post-op care and learning, you know, these are the consequences, you know, cause and effect, this was the operation, this was the outcome. And I think that could be very instructive, just that follow through. So I've made sure, please do follow through patients in that way, just to kind of learn, well, if I do A, this is what I might expect 3 days down the line. And I think particularly around shift work and so forth, breaking up that kind of patient journey between multiple different doctors can make it difficult to be able to follow through a patient in that way. So I think if you've, you know, if you've done an operation, even though it might be difficult to track that patient through, and I'm sure people do it anyway, but I would just say, yes, that's a great thing to do, and please do ensure that it's sort of part of what you do as a trainee.
Yeah, definitely. That's some useful advice there. So do you have any other insights you would like to share about the transition from working and training in the UK to Australia?
I think obviously, I suppose, coming in the UK, I've worked with, and particularly in London, worked with an awful lot of Australian doctors and New Zealand doctors, and as well, particularly around cath lab and in a surgical unit or in a cardiothoracic unit, a lot of nurses and other health professionals who've come from overseas. And I think it's not until you make the transition yourself, coming from one country to another, and although, you know, we speak the same language, we work in what on the face of it seem to be fairly similar health systems, there's underneath the surface, there's so many differences. And I think I've found it, you know, it's been an incredibly useful thing or interesting thing for me to do, to come and now looking back and how much respect I have of all the people that have come from, you know, that they came from their home country, who haven't been very familiar with a health system and landed in the National Health Service in the UK. And obviously, you know, landed running, you know, I could not tell, you know, that these were not, you know, these were just as good, if not better, than the people that would have perhaps come from, you know, a UK training perspective. And so, yeah, I think, you know, people listening to this, who are probably not from, you know, who may not have worked overseas yet, you know, I suppose in a way it's be kind to your international colleagues, because it can be quite a tough gig when you just, you know, when you've just landed and you are trying to sort of obviously do the day job, but at the same time understand and navigate the system, which can, you know, although as I say, they might look similar, but actually underneath they're different, and, you know, different in quite complex ways.
Yeah, definitely. All right, so that's all we have time for today. Thank you for taking the time to chat
with me. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you.